The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season 4 with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, IsraelStory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Before we get to the show, an announcement. When you make a gift to the world, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks for your support. The violence in Hong Kong is growing. Some officials there say the protesters are being helped by American spies.
The rioters are very well funded. The equipment are first class, some say even better than the police. They have very good training, very good strategy.
Also today, the word corruption has been thrown around a lot in the impeachment inquiry. The central charge is that President Trump is corrupt. Trump says he was trying to root out corruption. It's all kind of rich, considering for decades the U.S. has been urging other countries to clean up their act.
By trying to root out corruption around the world, the United States is trying to present itself as a beacon of everything that can go right if other countries pursue a democratic government.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. Schools are being shut down in Hong Kong. The government there called it a precautionary move as protests have escalated. Today, China's President Xi Jinping accused the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong of violent, illegal activities. That is not the only accusation coming from Beijing these days. Some Chinese officials allege that the highly organized protesters in Hong Kong are being guided by U.S. spies. This theory is seeping into the highest levels of Hong Kong's own government. We learned this from a member of the city's executive council who spoke with The World's Patrick Nguyen.
Ronnie Tong is one of Hong Kong's top officials. He's advisor to Carrie Lam, the chief executive of the Chinese territory. He's also in touch with officials in Beijing. So I asked him, how do they view these protesters?
They think that it would be wrong to negotiate with terrorists.
Using the T word, terrorist, that is a big deal. Because nobody wants to compromise with terrorists.
You know, I'm sure the American government would have adopted the same attitude. American government has always said that they refuse to negotiate with terrorists. And this is what is happening in Hong Kong.
And what is happening, as Beijing sees it, is these radicals are mysteriously guided by a foreign superpower. And Tong now seems to believe that as well.
The rioters are very well funded. The equipment are first class, some say even better than the police. They have very good training, very good strategy.
You can see where he's heading with this.
If you go on the internet, people are being given precise instructions as to where to go, what to do, and how to do it. And I don't believe that that kind of organization is without direction from some powerful organization.
Now, some of that is just off. When it comes to equipment, Hong Kong's protesters wear Lycra running pants, gas masks from the hardware store. Some have Molotov cocktails. The riot police, they have RoboCop gear and loaded pistols and endless tear gas grenades. As for the internet, protesters do coordinate via apps and message boards, sort of a crowdsourced hive mind. But wouldn't it be weird if an uprising in one of Asia's most tech-savvy cities didn't use technology? Point blank, there's just no good evidence that this is some CIA scheme. And Tong admits that.
Obviously, I have no proof that there is American intervention into the affairs of Hong Kong.
But just the suspicion that homegrown radicals are backed by U.S. spies, that is taking this in an even darker direction. And to be fair, it isn't coming out of nowhere. Just imagine in some U.S. state, Americans marching, waving the Chinese flag, asking President Xi Jinping to back their revolution against their own government. and even singing the Chinese national anthem. Tong says the inverse of that is exactly what's happening in Hong Kong. So, of course, Chinese officials are alarmed.
Can you imagine what Beijing would think when they watch on television that you have people waving United States flags, going to the United States embassy to implore, you know, United States to intervene, calling for the liberation of Hong Kong? Can you imagine what, you know, a Beijing government would think?
Some protesters, not most, do wave U.S. flags, and there have been signs asking Donald Trump to assist their liberation.
If you start to invite the I wouldn't use the word enemy, but certainly the adversary of China to liberate Hong Kong, that torpedo any chance that we may have in obtaining true democracy in our lifetime.
The American flag wavers, I've talked to them on the streets, they say, yeah, we are trying to provoke U.S. politicians to intervene. And guess what? It's working.
And I'd like to speak directly to the people of Hong Kong. America stands with you, and America will always support you.
That's a Republican senator from Texas, Michael McCaul, standing next to a veteran of Hong Kong's protest movement named Joshua Wong, on the floor of Congress. Also present, Nancy Pelosi.
In Congress, Democrats and Republicans in the House and in the Senate stand united with the people of Hong Kong.
They're pushing a bill in Congress to support the protest movement. It's already passed in the House, and for Hong Kong official Ronnie Tong, he says this is all part of a plan to demonize Beijing.
Any nation which is in trouble need a common enemy. And President Trump has done extremely successful in creating a common enemy in the form of China.
To be clear, when Hong Kong's government uses words like rioters and now terrorist, they're mostly talking about the ones flinging gasoline bombs, the hardcore set, who won't back off even when cops draw their pistols and have been gunned down. That happened as recently as Monday.
Day in, day out, I watch Hong Kong slowly but surely turning into a war zone.
But it's getting to the point where all Hong Kongers who fear losing their freedoms, and there are a lot, they're being lumped in as foreign-backed radicals too. Most will never throw a brick, never wave a U.S. flag. They're just horrified at the behavior of the police. The way Tong describes protesters, violent, unhinged, that's how protesters see the police. One activist, who asked that I conceal her name, told me this recently as riot cops closed in on us.
They've just gone crazy. I mean, look at the way they treat people. They've just lost their mind. There's no bottom line, no moral code, no nothing.
Yet within Hong Kong's government, Tong says, the police are seen as highly professional heroes.
Well, I think we have seen the most restrained police force in the world. I don't think a bit exaggerating to see that.
Now, Tong is actually an outlier on Hong Kong's executive council because he says there needs to be reconciliation with the protesters, even the extreme ones. But for Beijing to even consider that, he says, the protesters will first have to put down all those American flags.
If what they are aiming at is to fight for democracy in Hong Kong, that is precisely the wrong way of doing it.
For the world, Patrick Nguyen, Hong Kong.
Fighting between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza went on shaky pause today after 2 days of clashes and roughly 450 rockets launched toward Israel. Israeli aircraft returned fire, reportedly killing at least 32 Palestinians, including about 24 militants and 6 children. No Israelis were killed, but life in half the country was brought to a standstill. This latest flare-up started on Tuesday when Israel killed a commander of the militant group Islamic Jihad. The tentative truce was reached thanks to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire. We've got two people we want you to hear from, one in Israel and one in Gaza. Major General Yaakov Amidror is a former national security advisor in Israel and a senior fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. He joins us from Ra'anana, Israel. Mr. Amidror, how is this round of violence different from the ones we've seen in past months?
First of all, it was initiated by Israel. We decided to take out of the equation the guy who initiated most of the last operations against Israel. He was a commander in the Islamic Jihad. And what we see is the reaction of the Islamic Jihad to his elimination.
Hamas is the official ruling force in Gaza, and Islamic Jihad is their rival. Do you know whether Hamas...
And the bigger organization with more capacities.
Is Hamas happy that their rival, Islamic Jihad, is being targeted?
I don't know. Happy is not a good word in this occasion, but I am sure that nobody is crying in Hamas about the fact that he is not anymore on the fighting force of the Islamic Jihad.
So who is Islamic Jihad anyway, and how are they actually different from Hamas?
Islamic Jihad is an organization which was established by the Iranians, financed by the Iranians, and Iranians are very much involved in the policy of the organization, unlike Hamas, which is original, genuine Palestinian organization, a branch of the Islamic Brotherhood, and getting a lot of help, money and munition and training from Iran, but it is not under control of Iran at all. And they are much more sensitive to the needs of the people on the ground than Islamic Jihad, which is a pure terror organization without any thoughts about the population in Gaza.
That's one perspective from inside Israel. Yaakov Amidror, former Israeli National Security Advisor and now senior fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategic Studies. And now to Gaza. Neda Nabil is a human rights activist and media coordinator at the Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor in Gaza. She says she was forced to evacuate her home once the bombs started to fall on Tuesday. She's since returned home, but is still a little shaken up by the latest violence. Neda, it is good news that you're okay and your home was not hit. How have these past couple of days been for you? Where did you actually find safety?
So I, with my family, with my father and mother, evacuated and go to one of my brother's home in an area in the central Gaza. We get used to that. This is not the first time that we evacuate our home, whether us or my neighbors or hundreds of people in Gaza.
You've lived through these shellings before. This is the 10th round of violence in Gaza in the past 18 months. What was different this time? Anything?
I left my home going to my brother one, and I spent all the night with his children. So this time was very difficult because I spent the night with two children feeling helpless to calm them. Another thing, for example, my cousin has his marriage party on Wednesday and totally canceled because of what is happening.
Mm. And that example you mentioned, the wedding party that got canceled on Wednesday, I mean, in between the punctuated violence, how do you manage to maintain an ordinary routine?
As the Gaza Strip has been going an Israeli blockade for 13 years, so every single item in Gaza is affected by this blockade. And imagine that we in Gaza, we only have 7 hours electricity a day. So I can say that I spend more than half of my age in Gaza without electricity.
Neda, I think Israel would say they would not be shelling Gaza if Gaza was not shelling Israel. Would your life be better if Gaza wasn't targeting Israel?
Actually, I think the Gazans do that as a response to Israel, as it is the occupation power that occupying. So I think life would be better if we don't have occupation on our land, sir.
The point you made earlier is a really good one, because even when the border is quiet, the blockade means that Gaza is experiencing a severe humanitarian crisis. So how does the civilian population maintain a sense of hope. How do you maintain hope?
I think we are a strong nation, because since Ivar, we have gone through many catastrophes and many wars. So when we keep our life, when we keep going to our work, when we keep them continued, it's a kind of resistance to this occupation. But they cannot take from us the spirit of life and the hope that we can live on.
That's Neda Nabil, a human rights activist in Gaza, and you're listening to The World. Hey there, listener. We have some exciting news. The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for independent, nonprofit journalism. When you make a gift to The World, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. Every day, we bring you in-depth stories from around the world that make you a more informed global citizen. You value the high-quality journalism you hear on The World. So make a gift to support it today at theworld.org/match. And thank you. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Money talks, don't you know? And that's good news today for environmentalists in Europe. Today, the European Investment Bank voted to stop investing in sources of fossil fuel, including natural gas. Previously, the bank had stopped funding coal, another energy source that contributes to climate change. We'll hear more about the bank's latest moves later in the program. The European Investment Bank's move today does not mean it's getting out of the energy game altogether. Far from it. It's just moving in a new direction, away from fossil fuels and toward renewable energy projects like hydro. Hydroelectric power plants dam rivers or divert their flow to create energy that's renewable, but it can disrupt the lives of people and animals alike. Journalist Lucy Sheriff has been reporting from one region where lots of these hydro projects are being built, the tiny Balkan country of Montenegro. Lucy, you found that right now there are 14 small hydroelectric power plants in Montenegro, but 49 more in development. Why dams instead of solar or wind, especially when these rivers are producing so little power?
There is a history of hydropower and dams in the region, and it hails back to when the area used to be Yugoslavia. And so in the Soviet era, during the 60s and 70s, a lot of these big dams were being built because they are, you know, the symbol of construction and of power. So these countries, obviously Montenegro, they know how to do hydropower really well. And they actually still have the plans from all those decades ago. So that is something that is driving dams and so profitable because of the incentives and the subsidies that are paid out. One private company can make a lot of money. So that's a huge profit for these companies.
How do Montenegrins feel about that?
Obviously, people are still angry because there is so much money that is being poured into these small plants and they generate such a minuscule amount of energy. I think it's something like 2.7% of Montenegro's energy comes from these small plants. So it's, you know, the bottom line is it's a lot of money going in and not much energy coming out.
So besides the issue of who's benefiting financially, what are the environmental impacts here? I mean, it sounds like these are small hydro projects. What kind of harm can they do?
When you talk about a dam, people think Hoover Dam and that kind of size. And even though there are dams of that scale in Montenegro, the projects we're talking about are very small. They're under 10 megawatts of electricity. But even though they're small, they still have a relatable impact to the environment. So they divert rivers into pipes that can run 1 or 2 kilometers, meaning that that entire section of the riverbed is completely dry. So obviously that hugely impacts the ecosystem, and it strips communities that are very used to relying on the river as a valuable natural resource. So you have communities who drink directly from the river because it's that clean. You know, they fish from there, they bring their cattle to drink from the river. And not only that, but socially and culturally, it's a very important part of the community.
So you visited a community in Montenegro where a hydro plant had been proposed, and it was going to be built on a river that meant a lot to the people who live nearby. What did you find there? What was the scene?
Yeah, so I went to Savnik, which is near Dermator National Park in the northwest of Montenegro. There are only around 100 people who live there in peak season, so in the winter, even less. And I went to this community and the locals showed me the river, and it's this beautiful, natural body of water that is so clear. You can see straight to the bottom. You know, you've got all these moss-covered rocks and these natural bathing pools, and the river's just sort of winding its way down through the forest. And one of the locals I spoke to is Alexander Dragicevich, and he's an environmental activist who's from the region. He lives in the capital, but he visits frequently.
This river is the heart of this whole area around here. People live around this river for hundreds of years. This river sustained them during the wars, during the famine, during the drought. So people that are farming up there, having their cattle and their sheep, are relying on this river to give them water and to sustain their lives.
So when a dam was proposed on this river and when the government approved it, what would have happened is this river that's this lifeblood of this community would have been diverted into these pipes, and essentially the water would have dried up.
So what did people like Alexander Dragicevich do about this?
So they decided to try and rally as many people from the surrounding communities to come and try to stop the machinery. So when it moved in, the locals actually chained themselves to the machinery, and then they camped out on the path that the company was trying to build down to the river for about 3 months. And they took shifts, they would switch every 10 days. And there were around 500 people that were involved in this protest. So Dragicevich explained that this incident actually brought people back together who hadn't spoken for years.
Nature united us and we prevailed. We won against much stronger enemy.
Sounds like the town was victorious in saving the river, but what about the forecast for hydropower across Montenegro?
They were successful in their protests, and the government decided to rescind the contract for that dam, and not only that dam, but also five other dams that were proposed. However, it doesn't look like it's going to completely stop projects being built, although I think it has definitely given campaigners hope that they're going to be able to replicate the success for other planned dams.
Lucy Sheriff reported that story for us, and you can read more at pri.org/theworld. Lucy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
For more than 40 years, Ebola has been one of the world's most deadly and terrifying diseases. But here's some hopeful news. For the first time, an Ebola vaccine has been approved by both European regulators and the World Health Organization. It was developed by the pharmaceutical company Merck. The vaccine's already been given to around 250,000 people in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where a recent outbreak of Ebola has claimed more than 2,000 lives. The vaccine can now be stockpiled by governments and rolled out to the countries most at risk. Peter Piot was part of the team that investigated the first known Ebola outbreak back in 1976.
It's really a happy moment for everybody who's been involved in Ebola from the beginning, because we finally have something to offer. And I think now we have to think how we're going to use these vaccines, making sure that people have access to them. In my view, every healthcare worker, every nurse and doctor in countries like Congo or Sierra Leone should benefit from vaccination against Ebola.
In DR Congo, there's further hope in the fight against Ebola this week. A large-scale trial of a second vaccine, this one from Johnson & Johnson, was announced. 50,000 people will be offered the vaccine in the city of Goma. They'll get two doses 2 months apart. Médecins Sans Frontières, or MSF, has been carrying out education campaigns for weeks ahead of the rollout. John Johnson is lead on Ebola vaccination for MSF.
In an Ebola outbreak, when you introduce a new drug or when you introduce a new vaccine, especially when you talk about something being experimental or new, there is a lot of questions. There can be a lot of confusion or mistrust. That's normal. And one of the things that we've been, you know, very clear on from the beginning is that we need to work very closely with the communities that we vaccinate.
The number of new cases in the DRC Ebola outbreak has already dropped significantly since its peak this past spring. It's hoped the new vaccines will help end the outbreak and prevent other ones in the future. You're with the world.
What do Goldman Sachs experts and leading thinkers have to say about trending shaping markets, industries, and the global economy? And what macroeconomic issues are on the minds of our clients? Listen to Goldman Sachs podcasts to find out. Available at www.gs.com/podcasts or any of your favorite podcast platforms.
Brazil used to be a leader in HIV prevention, but new cases are up and condom use is down.
When you talk to your friends that you have a sexual experience using condom, you're going to be a joke with them, you know.
A conservative social movement now also wants to limit sex education in Brazil. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The word corruption is being thrown around a lot these days by both Democrats and Republicans.
The devastating testimony corroborated evidence of bribery.
And now they accuse President Trump of malfeasance in Ukraine when they themselves are culpable.
Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and Republican Representative Devin Nunes there. The central question in the impeachment inquiry, did President Trump try to get personal political favors from the current Ukrainian government in exchange for military hardware? Republicans are pushing back, saying Joe Biden abused his power in Ukraine when he was vice president. Both parties are defending their stances as part of a longstanding American tradition of combating corruption overseas. So let's take a few minutes to examine this history and test the claims of the two parties. Ben Freeman is the director of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative at the Center for International Policy in Washington. We hear the word corruption used so much. I think it might be useful to just define it. What is corruption?
Yeah, that's a great question. Corruption to me is when somebody uses a public office that they have towards a private end. And that private end could be that individual financially profiting. It could be a relative of theirs benefiting, or it could simply be just getting personal favors for something that they do in their public capacity that they shouldn't be doing.
Why is it in the interest of the United States to fight corruption overseas?
A big part of the United States trying to fight corruption is to promote democracy. And by promoting democracy, the United States is trying to present itself as something of a lighthouse to the world, as a beacon of everything that can go right if other countries pursue a democratic government. And on some level, this stems from the Cold War when we were in sort of this existential clash between communism and, you know, liberal capitalist democracies. And so for a democracy like the United States to root out corruption, a big part of that is trying to make sure that other countries get the message that if you engage in democratic practices, if you root out corruption, if you do all these things, then you'll get to play on the same playing field that the United States gets to play on. We'll probably be more likely to trade with you. We'll be more likely to invest in your country. And people just will generally feel safer about interacting with a country that is less corrupt than with a country that's more corrupt.
When Vice President Joe Biden took a role in pressuring Ukraine to oust prosecutor Viktor Shokin in 2015, how well does that fit into the pattern of U.S. anti-corruption efforts?
Joe Biden's behavior in Ukraine, I think in many ways, it really fit the model of what we've seen from the U.S. in terms of trying to fight corruption abroad. Joe Biden certainly wasn't alone in calling out Shokin for his corruption. Many folks in the international community were calling him out at the time. In fact, we had a lot of Republican senators who were also calling him out at the time. The fact that Shokin was seen as a corrupt figure was very bipartisan here in the U.S. at the time. And in that sense, it was very emblematic of what we've seen in the history of U.S. anti-corruption efforts abroad, that we see this corrupt figure in a country that we're really hoping to work with. And we call for his ouster because of that corruption. I think where Biden does have shortcomings that are worth questioning is why Joe Biden didn't ask his son, who was on the board of an energy company, why didn't Joe Biden ask his son to step down? Mm-hmm. I think is a very, very fair question.
Republicans are also defending the efforts of Rudy Giuliani and other Trump representatives in Ukraine as a legitimate part of traditional U.S. efforts to combat corruption. So how well do those efforts fit the pattern of America's historic efforts to fight corruption overseas?
I think in many ways, the efforts of Rudy Giuliani in Ukraine and in other countries, too, are very unusual, to say the least. We're told from testimony that a big part of his efforts was to make sure the Ukrainians started investigations both into Biden and into the 2016 elections here in the U.S. if the story that we're hearing about Giuliani is true and his efforts really were principally to get the Ukrainian government to launch these investigations into Trump's political rivals, then that's not fighting corruption abroad. Nothing about that is trying to prevent corruption abroad. In fact, that itself is, to me, a corrupt act, and that's trying to get a foreign power to investigate one's own political rivals. So that, to me, is corrupt, and it certainly doesn't fit the long history the U.S. has of trying to root out corruption abroad.
Ben Freeman of the Foreign Influence Transparency Initiative in Washington, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Brazil may soon change what young people are taught about sex. A conservative social movement is pushing legislation to limit sex education in public schools, and it's supported by Brazil's president. It's alarmed the public health community at a time when HIV is on the rise among young Brazilians. Catherine Osborne has that story from Rio de Janeiro.
Reinaldo Ribeiro and several young men haul a big tent and a duffel bag onto a busy street corner in Rio's nightlife district. It's Thursday, and they're getting to work.
We have a big bag with condoms and lube to offer to the people.
They unroll a banner that offers free rapid HIV testing and counseling.
We have banners talking about prevention, STD, and prejudice about a lot of stuff.
Hibido is an educator at a sexual health nonprofit. And when he started giving workshops 10 years ago, most of his clients were public schools. But now he says they rarely seek his services.
The public school is closing the doors.
And that alarms him because HIV among young Brazilians is on the rise. The number of new cases each year in 15 to 24-year-old men has more than tripled over the past decade. Studies show condom use is decreasing in that same group. One of Ribeiro's volunteers, 19-year-old André Batista, says he's not surprised.
So when you talk to your friends that you have a sexual experience using condom, you're going to be a joke with them, you know.
He admits that the sex ed classes he got in school weren't great.
When the teacher talked about it wasn't comfortable, we laughed. You know, we make jokes about it.
But at least there was a class. Ribeiro says when he surveyed more than 200 HIV-positive youth, only about half said they were taught in school how to prevent STDs. Jacqueline Pitangui, with the human rights group Sepia, says she expects awareness to fall even more.
What you are seeing is something really dangerous because it's a dismantling.
She says a growing conservative movement is trying to block discussion of sexuality and reproductive health in school. And one of its main cheerleaders is President Jair Bolsonaro. As a candidate, he railed against sex education classes.
Eles querem sexualizar nossas crianças precocemente. É uma esculhambação o que fazem com a educação.
Once in office, he ordered a government recall of educational flyers for adolescents.
Você tira essas páginas aqui que...
On Facebook Live, he urged parents to tear out sections of the flyers that describe how to use a condom. Conservatives say it's finally a move in the right direction.
Precisamos atuar com muita responsabilidade.
Lawyer Miguel Naguib launched a campaign against what he calls overly sexual and overly political content in Brazilian schools. Naguib says parents should have more say in what their children are taught at school, and he encourages them to complain to school principals and even call out teachers on social media. After his campaigning, a book about how babies are made was recalled from elementary schools in one Brazilian city. All of this is a stark reversal for Brazil. Back in the 90s, the country was recognized as a global leader in responding to the AIDS epidemic. The government worked with public health and child psychology experts to design sex education programs for schools. Jacqueline Pitangui says,
in terms of reproductive health, access to contraception, really, there was a lot of progress in Brazil.
But by the beginning of this decade, the religious right was growing increasingly powerful in Congress, with the rise of evangelical churches. In 2010, the health ministry's flagship sex ed program for schools was cut back. And now, President Bolsonaro supports going even further and passing a law that would ban any education in public schools about sexual development. Some health workers are fighting back. Ribeiro's nonprofit is one of several groups taking the fight over sex education to the streets. At their nighttime stand, dozens of people stop by to talk and get tested for HIV. 21-year-old Milena Karina brought three friends who had never been tested before. She says the government's choice not to educate young people about this leaves them in danger. For The World, Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
Hands off. That is the message to Customs and Border Patrol agents. A federal court in Boston ruled that agents no longer have the authority to conduct suspicionless searches of phones and laptops at U.S. ports of entry. The number of these searches has quadrupled since 2015. Nathan Freed Wessler is a staff attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, which defended the case. The ACLU represented 11 plaintiffs. All of them legally reside in the U.S. Nate told us more about who they are.
We represent two journalists, some students, business people, a professor, a NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory scientist, and all of these folks at least once, and some of them a number of times, have been subjected to really extraordinarily invasive searches of their phones and laptops by border agents. About half or so of our plaintiffs are Muslim. A number of them are people of color. Tied up in our serious concerns about the government's practices are concerns about racial and religious profiling.
Is there a particular story, Nate, from one of the plaintiffs that kind of stands out for you?
One of our plaintiffs, a journalist, was traveling on one of these trips back from Montreal on a bus with his 11-year-old daughter, and they found themselves detained overnight in a border station while agents searched exhaustively through his phone, came back and asked him questions about items on the phone that related to his journalism. We have another client in this case who was trying to travel from Canada to the U.S. by plane. Border agents took her phone and told them they intended to search it. She informed them that there were emails and text messages on that phone that included her communications with her ACLU lawyer in this very case, privileged communications. Our client watched as a border agent clicked through and viewed messages between our client and her ACLU lawyer.
Nate, with a suspicionless search, if agents find something on a phone suddenly that they deem suspicious, what do they have the right to do? Can they keep the phone? Can they detain the person?
The government has claimed the authority to conduct these searches anytime it wants to, and then to use information they find through that search for purposes including immigration or customs enforcement, but also for just regular law enforcement, for prosecutions, for adding to government databases that can be searched and queried by numerous other law enforcement agencies later. And there's a reason that the framers of the Fourth Amendment two centuries ago put some limits on when police are allowed to search our private spaces and our private information. It's to create some friction to ensure that police and other law enforcement agents can only gather this kind of information when they have a good reason to do so.
And the Fourth Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights that prohibits unreasonable searches and seizures. The court ruled yesterday that searching electronic devices without suspicion is unconstitutional. How did the plaintiffs react to this ruling? Do they feel like this is vindication?
The plaintiffs in this case are thrilled. This is a real vindication of the concerns they've been raising throughout this case. So we are committed to continuing to fight for the rights of our plaintiffs and by extension, for everyone who travels in and out of this country every year, the hundreds of millions of people who find themselves at the border and deserve the full measure of protection under our Constitution.
That was Nathan Freed Wessler of the ACLU. Journalist, poet, and human rights defender Behrouz Bouchani finally has a taste of freedom. The Kurdish-Iranian arrived in New Zealand just hours ago after spending 6 years and 3 months being forcibly held in Australia's offshore asylum system on Manus Island off of Papua New Guinea. The World's Carol Hills has more.
After touching down in Auckland today, Bouchani was greeted by his New Zealand supporters.
No, just having a thank you. Thank everyone who come here. So I'm very happy.
Bouchani said he just wants to be free of the system, of the process. He said, I just want to be somewhere where I'm a person, not just a number, not just a label, a refugee. In 2013, Buchani was intercepted in Australian waters in a leaky boat full of refugees who'd embarked from Indonesia. At that time, Australia had just instituted its controversial policy of not allowing asylum seekers who arrived by boat to be processed in Australia. Instead, they were transferred to Australian-financed detention camps, one on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea and the other on the tiny Pacific island nation of Nauru. Buchani has hardly been sitting around these past 6 years. He's been a regular contributor to the Guardian newspaper, providing a first-hand account of Australia's offshore detention system. He's also been writing fiction. In January of this year, Buchani won Australia's most prestigious literary prize for his novel, No Friend But the Mountains. He accepted the award via video from detention.
I told them that I am a writer. That same person just laughed at me.
In July, he did a TED Talk, also from detention.
Hello, everyone. My name is Behrouz Buchani. Some of you will know me.
And he's been invited to numerous literary festivals that were willing to sponsor his travel. Several months ago, a secret plan was hatched. The UNHCR provided the documents that would allow him to leave Papua New Guinea, and they made sure those papers would be accepted for entry by other countries. Amnesty International sponsored Buchani's visa and smoothed over other bureaucratic barriers. Papua New Guinea agreed to let him leave. Then Buchani and his team decided to accept the invitation to a writers' festival in Christchurch, New Zealand. But the trip wasn't a straight line. He flew first to the Philippines, where he had to wait 19 hours inside a tiny transit lounge before getting his connection to New Zealand. Buchani is now in Christchurch for that writers' festival. He'll stay in the country for 1 month. And he's been accepted for asylum in the United States. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
The European Union is putting its money where its mouth is. The European Investment Bank voted today to stop financing new fossil fuel energy projects by the end of 2021. The EIB is the largest development bank of its kind and is doubling down on more investments in renewable energy. The World's Environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
As U.S. leaders step back from international efforts to combat climate change, Europe is positioning itself as the new climate leader.
Our most pressing challenge is keeping our planet healthy.
German politician Ursula von der Leyen leaned hard into this message during her bid to become president of the European Commission this summer.
I want Europe to become the first climate-neutral continent in the world by 2050.
Von der Leyen told the European Parliament that goal would take ambition and money. She said she'd propose a new sustainable investment plan for Europe.
And turn parts of the European Investment Bank into a climate bank.
Von der Leyen's green message helped get her elected president of the European Commission this summer. And days later, the European Investment Bank released a draft of its new proposed energy lending policy.
We want to increase our support for the energy transition in Europe.
This is the bank's vice president, Andrew McDowell, announcing the plan this summer. It would commit half the bank's funds to projects combating climate change, and it would take another major step.
That we stop financing new fossil fuel-based energy projects by the end of 2020.
Last year, the bank lent about $2 billion to fossil fuel projects like natural gas pipelines and storage. And that's not unique among these big public banks like the European Investment Bank or the World Bank that loan money for infrastructure, public works, economic development, and the like. Sonia Dunlop from the environmental think tank E3G argues that this fossil fuel spending is at odds with their mandates to loan money for the public good.
For every dollar that it invests in a renewables project, for example, if it is then investing another dollar into a fossil fuels project, it is basically cancelling itself out.
Dunlop says with this vote, the EU is aligning its lending with its environmental policies.
And it's about making sure that the bank as a whole is aligned with the global Paris Agreement on climate change.
But even within climate-friendly Europe, the proposal met with a lot of pushback from Germany and other countries that rely heavily on natural gas. And in fact, in today's vote, EU member states agreed to keep funding fossil fuel projects a year longer than originally proposed. Alexander Dukas from Oil Change International says that delay is frustrating for activists like him who've been pushing for urgent climate action.
It just shows that there's still a disconnect between what our political leaders are doing and what millions of climate strikers are demanding in the streets.
Still, Dukas and others view this as a landmark move.
The new policy is an important signal to the wider financial community that the era of fossil fuels is past. And even though the policy that was approved today is weaker than the original proposal, it still positions the European Investment Bank ahead of its peers.
The European Investment Bank stopped funding coal projects back in 2013. And with today's vote to end financing for natural gas, the bank has completed its pivot toward renewables. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
Now to Australia, where bushfires have been raging for days. My BBC colleague Shaima Halil joins us from New South Wales. You landed there Wednesday evening, your time. Tell us what you're seeing.
I'm in Coffs Harbour. It is a coastal town in New South Wales, just north of Sydney. And the first flight that we tried to get on was cancelled because of the thick smoke. And when you looked out, it was just this grey blanket, and it just hits you the minute you get out of the plane. It fills your airways, and you could see that the smoke has just rested there after days of the fires. So we went to a rural area called Nanna Glen, and when you speak to people, some of them are just still in shock. They didn't have the words to describe what they came back to, and some didn't even come back to their homes yet.
I was going to ask, have people evacuated, and what about fatalities?
We know that up until now, there are four people dead, and the material damage is colossal. So in New South Wales alone, 1 million hectares of land has been completely scorched. 300 homes have been destroyed. And when we spoke to people, we went up to a farm area, and it was almost surreal because on one side, you see this completely blackened ground. And then on the other side, there's still green grass and a farmhouse that's intact. And it just shows you how random the wind travels. That's the crux of how dangerous this is. You've got wind that just carries it through, and it almost skips through areas. That's why they're so hard to control.
The weather conditions you were just talking about, Shaima, high winds, hot temperatures, and then a pretty serious ongoing drought. I mean, we heard on Tuesday how that was really amplifying the fires. How are the conditions now? Any change at all?
The wind has settled quite a bit in the area where I am and in New South Wales in general. Temperatures have gone down. Mind you, that doesn't mean that the danger is over. You know, I was speaking to a firefighter yesterday, a fire chief in the local fire brigade, and he said, look, until we get rain, this is just going to keep happening. Until we get rain, this is our new reality.
In the background of all of this is this larger political debate in Australia about the role that climate change is playing in making these fires more frequent and more intense. We heard some pretty extraordinary comments on Australian radio a few days ago from Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormick.
We've had fires in Australia since time began. And what people need now is a little bit of sympathy, understanding, and real assistance. They need help. They need shelter. They don't need the ravings of some pure, enlightened, and woke capital city greenies at this time.
Australia's Deputy Prime Minister dissing environmentalists there. Shaima Halil in New South Wales, lay out for us this debate on climate change in Australia.
It's one of the most, if not the most, contentious and divisive issues in Australia at the moment. Remember, Australia is a country, is a place that has thrived on fossil fuels. It has a huge coal mining industry. It is almost like the Saudi Arabia of natural gas, as one politician has put it. And so this is really the bread and butter of the country. This is the big resource that's contributed to this huge economic boom. And so for people in power, for the government, they say, well, we're not going to give this up. We're not going to write a blank check with our resources and move on to renewable energy. And that was what was interesting here, is that in this extraordinary time of bushfires, they just wouldn't be drawn on that debate. The Prime Minister time and time again was asked about that, and he said, I'm not going to answer any questions about that. I'm more concerned about families and people. And of course, that's a valid point. But people are saying, and scientists are saying, if we're not going to have that conversation now, when are we going to have it?
The BBC's Shaima Halil in the smoke of the bushfires in New South Wales. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Marco.
Thinking of our friends down under. And that's where we leave you today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you all tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.